You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello there, Stu Goldsmith here. This is the Comedian's Comedian podcast, and I managed to abbreviate my own name there. I managed to make it, it was halfway between Stu and Stuart. Did you hear? Listen back to that. I think I said, hello there, Stuart Goldsmith here. Like that, you could just, Stu Gold. Yeah, I never know what to say when people bring me on. Other comics go, what do you want to come on as, Stu or Stuart? And I often say, I honestly don't care. That is just a tiny part of why my brand is not big. So let's get on with this. This is the wonderful Daniel Rigby. Now, as you will hear, Daniel Rigby is a BAFTA-winning actor. He won a BAFTA 10 years ago or so for his portrayal of the young Eric Morecambe. If you're listening outside of the UK, Eric Morecambe is one of the most loved and legendary key figures in British comedy. So we will talk a little bit about how scary it was. I think that's in the extras, in fact, because on this main episode, we're going to be talking about, and this is, you know, if you're a fan of this show, I don't know if you're coming to me from Daniel or if you're coming to me because you've listened to the last 401 episodes, but this is absolute ComCom bait. We're going to be talking about creativity, dread, anxiety, and why there is more of him than he intended in the ultra-nihilist protagonist of his recent audiobook, which he wrote and performed himself, Isaac Steele and the Forever Man. Now, you have had to suffer through me banging on about this audiobook for the last few episodes, and this is finally the episode on which we'll talk about it. I cannot recommend it enough. You can find it only on Audible, but it is absolutely worth signing up for the free trial for. And why not, if you're again Bezos and the likes of him, then why not set a reminder in your calendar to remind you to bug out before the end of the 30 days? But holy heck, do give Isaac Steele and the Forever Man a solid go. I was probably 5 minutes in when I thought, yep, I'm going to listen to all 13 hours of this. It's an extraordinary achievement. If you're a fan of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and things of that ilk, I think you're really going to love it, with bits of, I mean, not necessarily influences, but in terms of tone, things like the Framley Examiner is in there somewhere, or is it the Framley Examiner that has those incredible things like Beware the Void and all those kind of local parish notices? I think it's from something else. Nonetheless, we will talk about the creation of that book. We will talk about what, if anything, might be happening next for Isaac Steele. And we'll be talking about Daniel Rigby's return to stand-up and the fact that despite being a BAFTA-winning and an incredible actor with a phenomenal comic and proper CV, he still doesn't feel like he's proper because he hasn't done stand-up for some time and is now returning to it. So we're going to get stuck into that. Go to comedianscomedian.com/insiders to join the Insiders Club for 25 minutes of extras, including Daniel on that responsibility he felt playing Eric Morecambe on screen, how he manufactured a middle-class bumble to disguise his working-class background, and more stuff on the journey of stand-up rather than the destination. It's a cracker. Let's get into it. This is, I can't believe as a podcaster I just said, let's get into it. Oh my God, I humbly apologise. But let's get into it. This is Daniel Rigby. The thing I'm most excited about is Isaac Steele and the Forever Man, great, which is your brilliant audio book that I've made a lot of assumptions about, such as it was your COVID project.
Right,
all that kind of thing. Don't know if it was, what have you. But I kind of want to... I never do this. I always get 10 minutes into an interview and then go, God, I haven't told them I think you're funny. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
So let me start with
No, I feel like that kind of implies that I think you're funny. So maybe that's enough.
So
maybe
you have to say it. Yeah.
Why don't you...
It'd be nice for you to say it as well.
Oh, you're really funny. Well, the thing is, you're really annoying because you're one of those people that seems to be really good at everything. But also, I feel like I know enough of your mentality from the small amount we knew each other back in the day.
Yeah.
That you'll probably go, oh, no, you'll probably have the mentality of going, oh, no, I'm just a complete shit and I can't cope with anything, and be all actorly like that.
Yeah, that's good insight. That's good psychological insight, yeah.
You started off as a comic. You were on the stand-up circuit.
Yes,
did stand-up, and it wasn't... Was it sketches as well? Or was it were a stand-up whilst being a proper actor?
I was doing... Well, the first thing was acting and drama school, and then a couple of years after that, I was doing a play in Nottingham and started doing stand-up on my own while I was rehearsing the play.
Okay.
Went to Chortle and found a gig. Mm-hmm. And started doing stand-up, and then never really gigged with sketch and character stuff, just kind of accidentally put... Always wrote sketch and character stuff, hadn't performed it, and then did an evening at my drama school in the bar, just performing sketches, and my... agent for stand-up came along to that and said you should do that as a show, so I sort of took that almost completely wholesale in the classic way that I am, i.e. lazily, and just did that in Edinburgh.
Okay, was that the Mothwalk Fantastic?
That was that, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I remember the title. I don't think I ever saw the show. How do you feel about it now?
About the show?
Yeah. Is it sort of I can stand by that was me at the time doing the best, or do you look back on it thinking, God, I didn't know what I was doing? Or
I think there's just, it went well, and I enjoyed doing it, but I feel like that formative few years of doing live gigs and doing comedy, I never really got a grip on exactly how I should be working, what my thing was, why I was... Not why I was doing it. It's always felt like comedy is my thing. That's always what I've wanted to do. But never properly found my voice. And I wish I'd worked harder. I think I look back on it and go, it went quite well. You didn't need to necessarily try harder. So you didn't, you know. So I look back on it and go, the show was... I'm happy with... some of the sketches, looking back on them, but I think I could have, with stand-up as well, I think I could have, at that time, worked more professionally and been more aware of what I should have been doing, you know, doing my full time on stage, for example, and writing new material more regularly. I think mainly out of fear, I would just do the same things over and over again and cling on to material for dear life. So I look back with that kind of feeling about that time.
And how long is it firmly in the past? Is stand-up something you'll never return to?
Well, Stuart, only a couple of days ago, I've booked my first stand-up gig in 9 years.
Fucking A.
Yeah, so I think it's always what I've wanted to do. I mean, it really is all I've ever wanted, is to be a stand-up. And I kind of stopped doing it acting... I have, you know, it didn't really take over. I think that's a bit of an excuse, because it feels like I just let fear take over, because a couple of acting jobs interfered with the rhythm of doing a lot of gigging and doing Edinburgh, and you know, I couldn't 1 year, fell out of the habit, and then let the fear dictate that I wouldn't do it again. It's always felt really, really important as well. So it's that I think there's something at my core which is afraid of it because it feels so important, perversely.
Why do you think, what's your theory for why stand-up feels so important to the kind of your self-image?
I know this sounds absolutely ridiculous as well, because I've not done it for like almost a decade properly. I don't know, I think it's just that funny and being, feeling funny and trying to get a laugh has always felt like a really good thing in my life, and I think I built an identity around it when I was a kid.
Yeah.
I mean, that's total cliche, but I think that is genuinely what has happened. And so probably for very deeply unhealthy reasons, it feels like it's the main thing I've got to offer, and it's the core thing about me, and that I have to try and do it.
That's so good. That's so exciting.
But what would you? What would your advice be if you hadn't done it for 9 years? What would you? How should I?
So you haven't done a gig.
I did one
years.
Gig.
Okay.
I did one gig 6 years ago at the invitation of Aisling B in Los Angeles.
Okay.
And I did mainly. I did some stuff about. I did some new stuff about LA at the beginning of it, which probably lasted all of 45 seconds, and then I did some old stuff. And it went brilliantly, and I thought, oh, great, I'm just going to do this again. But that just didn't materialise.
Okay. Were you nervous before going on and doing that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Terrible, terrible nerves. Always.
And do you think the nerves... I won't pretend to give you advice in any kind of official capacity, but I've probably got things I can say about it. But what do you think the nerves are about? Are the nerves because it's so important to you? Because I'm interested... Because it's one of those situations where, you are a phenomenal actor. You're a really funny comic actor. You're a proper actor. Like, you won the BAFTA for, I don't know the title of it, the best acting performance.
Yeah,
For playing Eric Morecambe, best actor. Best actor. Best actor. Sort of thing I should have known. For playing Eric Morecambe in Eric and Ernie, 11 years ago,
Nearly 11 years ago, yeah.
And notably at the time, beat both Benedict Cumberbatch and
Matt Smith? And Jim Broadbent, which is ridiculous, isn't it? Much, much better.
One in the eye for Broadbent, Smith and Cumberbatch.
All of them furious.
But, that's, that and the things you've done since then, Landscapers, Flowers, which I'm just obsessed with. I think Flowers is brilliant, which is not to be sniffy at all about Landscapers, which I've also seen him as great, and Black Mirror. You have a proper healthy acting CV by anyone's standards, but do you feel deep down like you're still a big failure because you haven't mastered stand-up comedy?
Absolutely.
I feel
it's pathetic, isn't it? Isn't it pathetic? It's also just this typical thing, isn't it, about human beings? You feel like every human being you talk to is like, oh, I've got the wrong life. I should be this, or I should be that. I want this. I want what I don't have. But and I know it sounds like massively ungrateful for what I do have, because I know I'm in an extraordinarily lucky position with my acting career. But acting always felt like it happened accidentally because I wanted to do comedy, and there's no educational route in to stand up or anything like that, but you can go to a drama school. It just felt like performing was always a byproduct of wanting to do comedy.
This is a wild long shot. Mm. Is there a relationship between the fact that you secretly prefer stand up to acting and how good you are as an actor? Because I think some people, if all you wanted to do was be an actor, would it make you a less good actor? Do you know what I mean? Because would one be needy as an actor because one wanted it so desperately? Or is there kind of if you sort of secretly regard it as your backup gig, does that mean that you can be casual about it?
I feel like that's an absolutely impossible question to answer.
Okay.
But I feel like it's part of a trope of things that people say about auditions, which is if you go in and you don't want it, you'll get it, because you're more relaxed or... But I do love acting, and I try really hard when I'm doing it. So I don't want to sound completely laissez-faire about it, but maybe there's something in that. It's just hard to.
It's just funny. Measure. I think that's what I'm getting at is the audition thing. Obviously, the stand-up version of that, as I'm sure you know, is the less you care about the audience. Often, the funnier you are, the truer, the more honest you are.
Right.
And it's just interesting. I think that's quite. Interesting, the relative amounts through which one is kind of does need get in the way?
I guess the kind of comedy that I always dislike the most when I see it is the comedy that sits up and begs for a biscuit. The stuff that's really, you can tell how badly someone wants that laugh. Mm-hmm. I always feel like the most successful comedians that I see, and the most successful comedy in theatre, and is something that has a bit of a, it's holding something back from you. It needs you to do a bit of work.
Yeah.
There's a bit of a secret there.
You were saying the, you can sense that, that's your least favourite kind of stand-up, where you can sense how much they need a laugh.
Yeah.
And yet you seem, in the 13 minutes we've done so far, to really need a laugh.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Is there... Because I think often when people go, let's make it personal. Certainly when I've been like, I hate that kind of comedy or that particular act. Yeah. Part of it is because I secretly recognise myself in it. Oh. All my fears about myself.
Absolutely. Probably. Definitely. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And also, it's really important to bear in mind that I don't have a fucking clue what I'm talking about. as soon as I say something, you know, it's good to pontificate, but as soon as I say something, there's a voice in my head going, you're talking absolute shit. So that's also important to remember as you listen to the podcast.
It's funny because you do have that kind of, like, I remember I listened as part of my research, I listened to an interview you did in Montreal.
Oh my god.
So that must have been like 9 years ago or so, something like that.
No, that would
have
been
more. 13 years ago. So what were the circumstances under which you went to Just for Laughs in Montreal?
Oh, that was pretty...
Were you like an early award winner or something in comedy? What was the route there?
I won Laughing Horse New Act of the Year 2007.
Okay.
Was a finalist in So You Think Funny that year. And yeah, very quickly there was a... booked a lot of gigs, and ended up on the Pleasance, in the Pleasance Review Show the year after.
Okay.
And through that, got an audition for the Montreal Comedy Festival, okay. which was actually 2009, and I was doing songs for it. It was my music. It was because I used to do really stupid songs in the sketch show.
Okay.
And very weird, very stupid songs, and the booker for Montreal came to the Pleasant show and it went terrifically that night, and so booked me for Montreal, and then I turned up at this, the music show was it's called the same thing every year. Bo Burnham was the year, he was in it the year before, but that year Reggie Watts was emceeing, brilliant.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
Love him. And Dead Cat Bounce were in it, and then the rest of it was a lot of hip hop and rap, high octane, big acts that were doing like energy pumping stuff, and I would come out and do a whimsical song about a worm that wants to be an accountant with a little keyboard, and wowee, people didn't know what to make of that. Yeah, so that was Montreal, but I can't remember being interviewed.
Were there moments in your comedy career, such as that night when you spanked it and got noticed by the Montreal booker,
yeah,
where you really felt like, I'm doing the thing properly, I'm the proper thing, I've got it here, I've got it by the throat?
There were definitely times where there were times when I felt at home on a stage and doing it and doing the shows. And I did a stand-up hour the year after, that I remember in the middle of that run feeling, because also I'd never done so many so much stage time consecutively, because it was my first proper stand-up show, and there was a settling that happened. So I still get nervous, but it wouldn't be fight or flight, climbing the walls stuff, and there was a settling, and it did feel like, okay, this is at home, and you know, a lot of the time the show went well, so it felt good, and yeah, like I was doing it proper. I just didn't keep it up.
So this is Daniel. Tremendous fun talking to him, and really great to discover that he is an angry weirdo, or rather that he is able to contact that part of himself, which is an angry weirdo, when performing brilliantly as he does. And, you know, the book Isaac Steele and the Forever Man is, as well as being light-hearted in a lot of places and silly and imaginative, incredibly, exorbitantly imaginative, it also is kind of suffused with this sort of existential dread, horror, as Daniel will say, we'll go on to say nihilism, and it has as solid a recommendation as this humble podcaster feels able to give you. So, Insiders Club, if you're in the Insiders Club, not only have you got extras from every episode that that has them, but you will also get 25 minutes of extras, including Daniel on playing Eric Morecambe, the cross between, or the dynamic between his working class roots and the middle class affectations that were forced on him by numerous dead arms at school, and more besides. So lots to get into there. Join the Insiders Club at comedianscomedian.com/insiders. £2 a month, or as much as you would care to donate. Everyone gets the same stuff. And I've got some ideas for a big Christmas merch thing. And yes, other podcasters, if you're listening to this and thinking, God, I mean, it's only May. Now's when you've got to be organising your Christmas merch, because every November I think, oh, I really should have organised some Christmas merch. Let's see if I manage to do it this time. Now, loads of work in progress and previews and all sorts coming up. If you have been a fan of The Infinite Sofa and you've been following Sofa So Funny, which is the comedy night started by Leslie Gold and featuring many of the denizens, what can I call them? The community, the horrors, the absolute horrors from The Infinite Sofa. They are, loads of them have been doing stand-up, and I'm going to go and headline a gig there. It's coming up soon on the 13th of June. That's Monday the 13th of June. It's in London Bridge, so have a look for that. It's on the mailing list, if there's a link to it on the mailing list, in which I got the name of the show wrong. Saws. Come along and see that. There's all sorts of exciting things happening as well. I'm meeting producer Callum in person for the first time, having known him for 2 years. Extraordinary post-pando thing. I've got a creativity conference that I'm speaking up. That's coming up soon as well. Loads and loads of work in progress shows, often with Sarah Keyworth or Nabil Abdul Rashid. We are going to be doing all sorts of things around the southwest. So I'm doing loads of things. I mean, those guys are all over the country, but I'm keeping mine to places like Swindon, Bournemouth, Cirencester, or Cicester, to call it its correct and deeply pedantic name. Salisbury, Bath. Where's that one? That's in Cardiff, in Barry. In Barry, in Cardiff. And Fordingbridge. Me neither. All of those things are coming up, so keep an eye on at ComComPod on Twitter and indeed on Instagram. And also, you could bloody well actually go to Instagram for once, because there is starting to be content on there now. And Callum and I will be pumping out, I regret saying that, but we will be sloshing, what's the word for uploading things? Sloshing, Christ. We'll be putting a lot more on Instagram.com/ComComPod, as no one formats that sentence. In the days and weeks to come. So let's get back to this conversation with the fantastic Daniel Rigby.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
What do you think it is that casting directors look for you for? Like, is there a particular flavour you have or that you offer that is either purely acting? You know, some people are sort of often castable as, I always think the sorts of people that end up playing the president in several different movies, you go, well, clearly they're presidential, aren't they? Or the bad guy, you know, what's his face? I don't remember the name of the actor, but Mike from Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he's, yeah. God, my God, isn't he brilliant? And then you see a video of like, oh, he was one of the two baddie cops in Beverly Hills Cop.
Yeah.
And you go, oh, fucking hell. He's like, he's kind of morphed in that kind of way. So the way that actors cut, I mean, and my vocabulary for analysis is much better for stand-up than for acting, about which I know relatively little.
Yeah.
But what do you think it is that you, like, what sort of roles do you get offered? What sort of thing is it that people go, we need one of them, let's get Daniel?
I think it's a nondescript face. I think they need, because quite often I'm putting either a wig or a pair of glasses, or that Guess Who element to it, the potato head. They need a potato head to put a mustache
on. Come on!
A pair of glasses and some ears. I don't know. I don't know. I play a lot of... I mean, I would hope that... I love playing comedy and getting it under the hood of comedy scripts and doing that. And I hope that that's something that I bring. But in terms of, yeah, I play a lot of kind of angry weirdos.
Yeah. You do, you do. And you don't look like an angry weirdo, but
oh,
you
thanks.
Kind of smell like one. Do you know what I mean? You look like you've got, like, I've probably referred to the show in the past, but my best friend at school had this quality whereby he was a little sort of arguably nerdy guy in his NHS specs with Transformer logos on them, but no one ever fucked with him because he just had the whiff of I might be mental.
Mm.
And I wonder if there is a sort of, there is a whiff of a kind of repressed anger to you.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
Like, you look like you could kick off.
Okay. Right.
Whilst apologising. Do you see that? Does that observation resonate at all?
Yeah.
Do you think that? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely. Yeah. That might be what they want. That might be the product that they're after. Is that repressed rage?
Could you kick off at any minute? Do you feel that you have repressed rage?
No, I don't feel... well, I mean, do I? Is that an honest answer? I want to be honest with you, Stuart. I want to be honest with you. Well, I mean, I do have, I hope that I don't bring a sort of unhinged quality to every conversation. But there is... I mean, and I don't know whether it's something that I bring to parts, but there's a chaos definitely to that I feel, and I have a long, you know, long. I've lived with mental health stuff for ages. I mean, since being a teenager, and have got treatment for that, and in a way. Better place now than I have been in ages, but maybe that is there's an element of bafflement and anger and occasionally deep depression.
Yeah, okay.
But whether that's something that people can recognise, and I don't know. But it's all part of the mix, isn't it? I guess it is something that you as a person bring to a role, to a conversation.
By chaos, I think chaos is a really interesting word in that context, because it is, and that might lead us in a minute onto the Isaac Steele stuff, which is kind of a lone man taking on chaos and like the biggest kind of built out world of like a universe worth of chaos. But just to stay with that word for a second, as it pertains to, I don't really have a question about it. I'm just like, yeah, all of that makes sense.
Right.
I'm sorry, do you know what I mean? Yeah, like okay. Kind of maybe not repressed rage so much as repressed chaos or a repressed recognition of chaos.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like if I was casting a sort of Stephen King short story where, as a lot of his short stories are, a load of people get fixed in a situation and gradually go nuts at each other.
Yeah.
Like I'd call you because I'd be like, oh yeah, you could be one of them that's like turns out to flip out.
Right, right. Yeah. I mean my real life flip outs have been like really rare, thankfully. So but there is that element to, just being honest. I've definitely in my life, there's a constant. There's management going on quite a lot of the time. With, you know, I now manage through exercise and trying to eat better and all those, you know, the absolute cliche things
that all work and are all pain in the ass, and no one wants to do them when you suggest them. It does fucking work.
Yeah. So try and do it. But it's been a feature of my life that I do go to places that have occasionally terrified me and have sought out help when I've needed it. And that I think when you're a person that has that thing to manage, there's sometimes, and I don't know whether it's the truth of reality or not, you feel like there's a veneer to things that underneath there's this, which is how you feel, you're projecting how you feel, but if underneath you've got turmoil and negativity and battling all kinds of, like, a whole gallery of goblins and demons shouting shit at you, the chaos is there. You know, you feel like it's there underneath the surface. This might be a bit too intense.
I'm really happy hearing it, and I think it's fucking good tape, Daniel. I don't mean that. And feel free to redact as much of it as you'd like, but I don't think any of that would need redacting. I feel like I'm really appreciative that that's really honest, and I think people will really respond to that, because I think comics often talk about anxiety and fear and stuff like that, and anger comes up less often, but depression, as we know, I guess, is anger turned inwards, as they say. I don't have much of a relationship with anger pre-parenthood, but I do have a relationship with depression and with anxiety, and kind of my stuff is all like, am I good enough? And I don't think I'm living up to my potential, and I've kind of gradually sought to extract myself from that. And a big challenge in that has been like, oh, how good is my job for me? Mm. How good is my job at actually healing the things I feel about myself? Oh, and how good is it at providing a welcome distraction, a shitload of dopamine, and great, let's reset and let's not solve any of the challenges because now I feel amazing again. And then let's restart the clock, everyone, you know.
Oh, mate, I've had that conversation with myself so many times. Even with just any entertainment industry, which can feel like such a head-up-ass thing to do, whether if you're someone who it's not necessarily the best thing for your head to be up your ass, then whether you should be doing it full stop, whether it's a good thing, a healthy thing, I mean, who knows? Just it is the thing that I can do, but whether it's good or not, who knows? But
do you find kind of respite in acting in certain roles? Do you find that when you're, you know, just to come back to Donald, great example of repressed rage, or barely repressed, or not very repressed rage, which I realise now, I mean, it was probably a long time ago, Flowers. I don't know how long ago that was, but I just think the whole thing's a masterpiece. I'd only recently discovered there was a second series, so I tammed it all this week.
Oh, fucking nice.
Wow, great. What final feeling is there?
Yeah. I mean, that's Will Sharp, who is a real visionary.
Just incredible.
Yeah.
Just incredible. And what an amazing kind of like a Radiohead album change of a second series, when it just turns into a whole different thing.
Yeah.
But with that, when you're kind of doing the screaming mad Donald bits, which are just the most wonderful sort of depiction of this brother and son who's just kind of so repressed and trapped in himself.
Yeah.
Do you find them cathartic, I suppose, or like just purely from the opportunity? Certainly, when I've been down, if I can get on stage and get love bombed for complaining, makes me feel pretty good. Is there a parallel whereby you can kind of fucking shout it out and get it done for numerous takes? Does that help, or is that just a kind of, you know, tears of a clown cliche bullshit?
I don't know if it helps. I feel like there might be there's an easy access to it, which is I don't want to emphasize anger too much, because I'm really not a person who's like filled with like rage who goes around really cross all the time. I'm quite a nice person, but there's an access to that stuff that I think, and I think that in exercising it does feel a bit like a bit of a release, a bit of a valve on the pressure cooker or whatever being released. So maybe there is something in that. But I've always felt happiest expressing comedy. I mean, that's always been the... I sound like a ridiculous human being because
I haven't done it in
a professional
shut
context.
Shut up. No, you don't.
But you know what I mean? Like that feels like a very happy place, is writing something and putting it out there and having people laugh. That's always felt like the good thing.
Tell me what you mean by getting under the hood of comedy when you were talking about like taking a character or a role, I believe you call them, you actors.
Very nice.
Like to get under the hood of it, what does that mean, as pretentiously and personally and intimately as possible? What does that mean to you?
I guess it just means trying to think about what makes it work. and why it works is different for almost everything in comedy, the different styles. And I love trying to pick apart what it is that's funny about something. And finding the rhythm of, like, it feels like for me anyway, tempo is such an important part of comedy that there's always a finding the correct rhythm for a bit in a script or that feels the funniest. That's always a pleasurable avenue.
And is there, do you, because one of the things that's always sort of not confused me, but I think it's a really weird quirk of TV comedy is that you don't get the final say on which take they use or how they edit it and, like, all of that crucial rhythm stuff. How do you feel about that? Do you just kind of try and offer as many rhythms as possible and hope your favourite one gets through? Like, what is that? That's a really naive question. But, like, what does it feel like from that end?
And that is strange. It's a, something that I definitely had. Because if you've got a good editor who's got a really good sense of it, then it's amazing. But sometimes you see something cut and you're like, oh, that's changed the rhythm of the delivery. And sometimes it feels like a shame. But
can you, without identifying it, can you be more specific? I feel like there's a...
I sort of was getting quieter and quieter because I was thinking I'm getting into what feels like a field of landmines professionally. But it's a curious thing about comedy, which it's so dependent on rhythm, but the rhythm is dictated really by people. You're not in the room when it happens.
Yeah.
So it's an unusual casting away of control, but a lot of brilliant editors just have that. They know they know it. You know,
totally still employable, Daniel Rigby. If you, like, you've been acting for, like, 15 years or longer, 20 years, something like
that? 18 years. Yeah.
So what have you, like, what are the kind of, I don't mean the tricks, but what are the sort of the shapes or the sort of approaches or secrets, if you like, that you've learnt now that you could go back and tell yourself 18 years ago? Like, I could imagine in stand-up terms, I could say to myself, fucking slow down, stop trying to do an impression of a comedian and just be you, and just keep slowing down and just describe something in more detail and more detail until they laugh. That, those kind of things. Yeah. They're like equivalent ones for acting, because I feel I was an actor for a few years, and when I kind of officially quit, I remember walking out of my acting agent's office because I got a comedy agent. I was like, oh, thank God, I no longer need to pretend to kind of care about certain bits of it. But I do sort of go, oh, I don't think I was entirely shit. I did work. It'd be quite good to sort of reappraise it somehow.
Yeah.
But I don't feel I could kind of talk about it or tell anyone how it's done.
Right. Yeah.
Like, so what sort of things, like, how's it done? how is acting done, Daniel?
Say the words out loud. It's very important. The biggest learning curve was getting on a TV set for the first time and realising there's no time for anything. And if you're not uber prepared and done all of your own work, then you're going to feel on the back foot on a set. Just so I would say to myself, know it inside and out, and don't necessarily, I mean, directors are different, but there are directors who will just leave you to do your thing on camera that is then immortalized forever, and will just leave you to do it. And they'll just leave you to it. So I would say be as prepared as you possibly can to be on a TV set. But I don't really have any really know. I don't really know anything.
is there anything you remember from RADA going, oh, that was the day it clicked, or that was the kind of the breakthrough moment? Was there like an exercise where everyone like did a particular, they released a certain muscle and everyone cried? That's what I associate with dark drama school.
There was crying class. Like, we did have crying class where everyone had to cry. There was just a whole... You have a whole load of shit just thrown at you at drama school, and you kind of take from it what you want, what you don't. Like, I'm not a method actor, but there's a lot of method stuff, and so I took a bit of it's useful to apply to scripts what you want to do to another character to get your head out of your ass a bit, and just what am I trying to do to the other person should always be the headline. So I took that away from, but I didn't take away the 3 days that I spent in the Enchanted Forest in Laban. Laban's actually really useful.
Oh, Laban is Laban's move notation.
Yeah, exactly. Yes,
it's like an incredibly complex, like a notation, like musical notation, but kind of four dimensional. In order to, you can write it, and then the person can look at it and do exactly what they said.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's different. It's just a vocabulary to describe. Different physical traits that you might be able to employ for a character. But as part of it, our teacher put us for 3 days in the Enchanted Forest, where I was a goblin called Gary with a little rag around my head that I hid under a table for a day, and then I called in sick. Didn't want to do it.
I meant to say, all of your performances display terrible physicality. It's a real shame.
yeah. It was a real pick and mix.
Let's talk about Isaac Steele and The Forever Man, because I think in the context of the conversation we're having, there's a whole other fun layer to it, which is you creating order out of chaos.
Right.
Just tell us what it is. You'll describe it better than I can. It's so fucking good, mate. Honestly,
thanks,
I loved it.
Thank you.
I loved it.
Thanks. Isaac Steele and the Forever Man is an audiobook. It's a story that is set in a ridiculous universe in the far future, and is sort of a parody of sci-fi and sort of a parody of noir tropes, but is also this kind of it wants to be a big rollicking daft space adventure as well. So that's
it's the closest thing to Douglas Adams. It's the closest thing to Douglas Adams. I copied out a quote from one of the reviews which said, not since The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy have listeners been offered such a joyful, anarchic and insightful universe. And it's, I think the moment it got me very early on, do you know what moment? Can you imagine, like, is it a thing that people say to you, oh, I like that bit, that early on bit?
It's always a different bit. Everyone's got a different one.
Because for me it was make my eye go big, I said, and my eye went big. From that, you just had me. I was like, oh my God, that's just told us that the character is somehow a cyborg or implant or something. It paints this picture of the world in which I'm like, oh fuck, we're in this world. And it was piss funny, and you delivered it brilliantly. And it's what's really funny, actually, looking at some of the kind of Amazon reader kind of reviews, or listener reviews, I should say, is that they don't necessarily know that you're a very successful comic and actor and comic actor. So some of them are like, yeah, he reads it not badly as well. Yeah, oh, no shit. So just tell me about how you wrote it. What were the circumstances whereby you sat down to write it?
Thank you, by the way. That makes me so happy.
I just love it.
It was an idea that's been around for absolutely ages, and it started as me noodling with a Blade Runner piss take, and because I've written prose, like, since I was a little kid, written prose stories and loved writing prose, and always wanted to try writing a funny bit of prose. So for years it was something that I was noodling around with, and then it was my agent said Audible are looking for this type of thing, and it has to be cross genres, possibly a series, ideally comedy, and it was just a perfect sort of fit. So then I put together a treatment, and and a sample of the stuff that I was sort of playing with, which was way more psychotic and weirder originally than what it ended up being. And then I sat down to write it and wrote a whole first draft with him being this kind of psychotic, because for listeners, it takes place in a universe that is ruled by Greatest Britain, which rules the Discovered Universe, and he works for the Department of Clarification, clarifying complicated situations between species and robots and all these kind of things. Yeah, I've lost my thread of what I was
talking about. You were talking about, you wrote the whole first draft of it.
Yes, so wrote a whole first draft of him being this kind of, like, real believer in Greatest Britain.
Okay.
And my idea was, could I make a really lovable far-right character? one of the challenges in my head was, could I start this guy who's basically a fascist working for fascists and have him come on this journey to realize, you know, realize the error of his ways, you know, by the end, and you love him. The editor on a Zoom call wanted to have a conversation with me because she asked me what my politics were. she basically was like,
you've got quite alt-right skin.
and she also said that he was that your protagonist in the email before the Zoom, she said, your protagonist is too disgusting to follow, which was quite. So I had to, that all went in the bin and rewrote it in the first lockdown. So that was the first lockdown project, basically, was the rewrite.
And tell me about the how much of the plot from that first draft stayed.
Not a lot, because I didn't have a fucking clue what I was doing. And it was really tricky. I mean, story is, even because I wanted to write a fairly traditionally structured story, adventure type thing. Well, it starts as a mystery, goes into a sort of space opera type place, but you think, it's really, really difficult, and I'm not very, I stared into the abyss a few times with it, definitely. A lot of it went in the bin. Some of the settings stayed the same. Some scenes stayed the same.
Please be as specific as possible, just because I'm a huge fan. I'd be interested to know which.
Well, he always went to the planet Cheadle.
Yeah,
and helped the enablement center there survive the siege. And he always met the giant
and the building, the kind of sentient
Patrick
building.
Patrick the building was in the first draft. Yes, some of those kind of settings and weird characters, they stayed the same. But I had to introduce I didn't have a subplot, and at the end it was all very, like, I raced to the end, because I was like, I don't know what I'm doing, I don't know what threads, I'm not tying up any threads, there's just threads everywhere, and I'm just covered in threads, and the end. And that was it.
And so talk to me about this. So your editor then says, hey, why don't we tie up some of these threads?
Yeah. Why don't you write an actual story?
And this is like the only long form thing you've ever done. Still, like, narrative, fiction wise, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
She was brilliant. Some of the elements that were already there, and said, maybe you develop this a bit more and have this as a subplot, and you tie those up and connect them somehow towards the end. But take this out, and she filleted out a lot of the other stuff that I'd just sort of thrown at the wall, and kneaded it up massively. Yeah.
So when you were writing it, was it even more chaotic than the finished product? Just to come back to that idea of chaos, because it is, like, if I were to visualize it, it's like a throbbing spaceport of a world. There's just stuff everywhere, you know. And different races and ludicrous names and brilliant ideas and kind of, like, you know, the Greatest Britain stuff and kind of oblique references to the council, and then eyes going big and spending splibs and never explaining it, you know what I mean? There's so much, like, it's such a I don't know, a romp isn't the right word, but I kind of imagine that you had a romp in the creation of it. It's such a joyful unrolling of someone's imagination.
Yeah. Well, I fired all of my comic energy into it, all of my creative, and that's been pent up for a while, and there's been this slight disaffected feeling in me of going, I've stopped doing live comedy, I'm not doing enough of my own stuff, and I just feel like I did turn in on that project and just sort of fire everything out of the brain.
10 years worth of no pointless car journeys.
Yeah, but it's also the, I mean, looking back on it, it's, I feel baffled by the world at the moment, and I feel it's sort of a piss take of how everything feels, which is this impossibly complex place with all kinds of stuff flying about, and how ridiculous if you had a department that would, a government department that was responsible for clarifying things.
Yes. Like all the kind of the tribunal sort of scenes.
Yeah.
Which are kind of like, they're a sort of mockery of a kind of Kafkaesque, or like the idea that all the civil servants, like if you hear them behind a door, you just hear people screaming, what the fuck is going on? And like that never changes and it never ends. It's just kind of, yeah, it's just like that does make sense to me as kind of as a response to the kind of chaos around. And how much of you is in Isaac now that we know he isn't far right? and it didn't follow that kind of path.
Yeah, I think when I when I read it back, I realised I'd allowed myself to maybe reveal more of myself in him than I'd intended or was conscious of. I mean, because he's a prick. I mean, and he's not that nice to people. He's an anti-hero in that sense, but he's got a good heart. But there are elements to him that there's this ultra nihilism to his thinking, and a background a comically exaggerated trauma in his life, and a way that he struggles to kind of exist. He struggles to relate, and he struggles to exist. I'm in no way close to what he is in the book, and it's all comically like wound, it's all comically dialed up to, you know, 10, but there's definitely elements of him that I read it back and I went, oh right, yeah, okay, I understand. I'm channeling when I felt like that, you know, recognize
yes.
that part, because I guess it's just something that I understood and could express.
Yes he's a repressed alcoholic junkie with a totally unique talent, or like I'm not suggesting that's how you regard yourself, you know, but he does, like, his ability, like the kind of one of the initial premises of the story is that he can speak and understand any language in a world full of language, full of different languages from all over the universe.
Yeah.
And so he does have a kind of an ability to communicate that kind of renders him useful somehow.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm leaving a gap there in the hope that you'll go, yeah, and I suppose communication's important to me, or something. I don't know quite what I'm expecting.
Yeah,
I know it isn't you. Sounds a lot like you.
What?
you reading junkie. The character. Yeah. No, I mean, his voice sounds like your voice as well.
Oh, it's my voice. Yeah. So, yeah. yeah, I mean, with some of that stuff the noir, that's the... His character is a kind of patchwork quilt of noir tropes that I'm taking the mickey out of, like his heroin addiction, his fat, he's always drinking. And what I thought might be funny is if he is an antisocial personality who struggles, and that he has the ability to understand everyone in the universe and has to communicate with them.
Right,
but it's slightly forced upon him, totally contrary to his nature, but I don't know how much that. I mean, in terms of the, I think where I exposed more of myself at my darkest is in the areas where he goes really nihilistic, or he goes down these holes, and you're aware because we're in his inner monologue. That's where I sort of felt the most like, oh, maybe I'm putting something out there that I didn't mean to. But yeah.
Do you feel nihilist or ultra nihilist?
I feel like it's hard to resist. And we live in these. We live in a time as well. It's really hard to resist it, isn't it? Because there's so much that's going on that there's been no bottom to the past however many years. You think that there's some bottom, and then there's something else, and you think, well, what is? And certainly recently, with recent events, it doesn't help the existential dread feeling. I think I do have to. I do have to fight it, because I know it's not a good feeling, and I mean, but if you don't have a belief system, and it is hard when all this shit's going on to contextualise it and make yourself feel better. It's hard to self-soothe your psyche in these situations. You just have to accept what's going on. How do you feel?
Well, I, as the owner-operator of two children, I have to be hopeful. I have to be optimistic, despite how I really feel deep down.
Yeah.
You know, I do, you know, a couple of episodes ago on the podcast, we had Eddie Pepitone, who is, I don't know if you've seen For the Masses, his latest special on YouTube. It's just incredible. And it is, as with all of his stuff, it's just a howl at the apocalypse and, you know, and the kind of the ludicrousness of where we are. How do I feel? I don't know. I certainly a couple of weeks ago, when Putin first started saber rattling about this special nuclear, you know, I've put the special division on, you know, high alert or whatever it was. I was with my family in the car and read that because my wife was driving, and I kind of read that and for an hour felt like the nukes were in the air and I alone had the information and I had to pretend everything was fine for them. And that was an extraordinary sort of feeling of like, oh yeah, what, you know, let's think of forward planning, like worst case scenario forward planning for someone that has kids. So, you know what I mean? That's
yeah. I have a recurring nightmare, which is, I mean, I'm oversharing way too much.
Come on, hit me.
Fuck it. I have a recurring nightmare, and the recurring nightmare is I'm in a place where I live, which is it never looks like where I live, looking out of a window, and I see a nuke hit, like a mile away, and I know that. And that's all it is, but it regularly happens, even without the news.
Yeah.
So the existential, you know, that's all. It's always.
How long have you been having that?
Years.
Really?
Yeah, but I mean, it's not.
Did
like
you watch Threads when you were a teenager or something like that? Is there some sort of? Did you attribute it to a particular piece of learning or someone saying something to you that you went, oh, that's what kicked that off? That's a fucking horrible recurring dream.
No. No, maybe it's from Terminator 2.
I mean, that one was pretty vivid, right?
Yeah, and she's at the fence.
Yeah. Is that fence? Why is that fence so important? Like, I know exactly, that's the first, as soon as...
You're watching it, she's grabbing it, and then she disintegrates. But maybe it's from that, I don't know. It just plays into that recurring nightmare perfectly. Yeah, the actual reality that we're living in at the moment.
Yeah. I think I've been listening to lots and lots of podcasts where military commentators say things like, look, there's absolutely no way he'll launch any nukes because, you know, it's just purely tactical gameplay, saber-rattling, showing you he's not afraid, trying to scare everyone, trying to bully everyone. He knows as well as anyone else there's no winners if you do that.
Yeah.
And I'm like, cool, I'm going to totally believe that then. I'm like, grab onto a thing. I adhere to this, actually. Yeah. I believe what this particular former general said, so everything's going to be fine, and then I'll believe that for a bit, and then I'll just let myself distract myself. I'll just kind of go, oh, well, you know, I feel like hell now, but... something will do. Oh, look at, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Just kind of rely on being distracted. He's awful. He's awful. But I've got to be optimistic. To return to the abyss, I mean, there's literally an abyss. What's it, not the great IO, but what's the absence?
Yeah.
Do you recognise not just with Isaac, but do you recognise elements of the world as being like a development of your psyche or your preoccupations?
Oh yeah, probably. Yeah, the absence is this irradiated wasteland, which in my head it's a whole continent which has been eradicated by humanity, which just feels like something humanity would do. And that, yeah, that's obviously out of that nightmare and, but yeah, those preoccupations.
And how much of the world did you plan and how much did you discover by writing it? Like, just purely technically. It's a facet of how much I love it. And I was like half an hour in going, I should have fucking written this. I love all of these things. I love all of this territory. I should have fucking print me. You know what I mean? I want to know, just technically, when I come to write my great boiled sapphire, how much am I planning in advance? How much of the world is there in your head before you put finger to keyboard?
It was knocking about for absolutely ages, I would say close to 10 years. So it was fairly well formed by the time I came to write it out properly as a project.
Oh, dear listener, I couldn't have written it. I hate to be starting from now. I'll write it in 10 years.
But in terms of the world building, I did start making notes specifically about how everything worked before I sat down and wrote the first draft. I thought I'm gonna write down how the politics works, how the economics works, how it all functions. Really boring, dry stuff, but just stuff that to make it more solid in my mind.
Yeah, to make sure you don't get to the final chapter and go, oh God, that doesn't make sense.
Yeah,
this key defining thing couldn't have happened.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I did do a fair amount of that, but to be fair, a lot of it happened in the writing of it, and a lot of it changed as well, just to suit the story. So it wasn't cut and dried. Yeah.
And what are your big sci-fi kind of lodestones in your own, you know, in your own love of sci-fi?
Yeah. Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, obviously. Blade Runner. Watchmen.
Yeah.
Alan Moore.
Did you watch the recent TV series?
I did, yeah.
I fucking loved it.
Yeah, I loved it.
Absolutely,
yeah. It
was great. That.
Terrific. And what else? I mean, there's a lot of Rick and Morty, I feel, and South Park, you know, those sort of animated comedy world.
The kind of irreverence of them, the sort of like, nope, they're dead, that kind of, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. The because comedy callousness is something that's always really appealed to me. And I always find it very funny, but it was something I definitely had to dial down after the first draft. There was way too much of it in it. The risk is, because it's just a slice, it's one conversation, you end up feeling like you're representing yourself as something.
Yes, of course.
You're like this grim, depressive person, which is only like part, like a little part, sliver of the truth about you.
Yes.
And also, there's something about talking about that stuff, which I've never really done, but it feels like when people... It feels glib, especially when celebrities or when people I follow on social media, it always feels like lip service, because the reality of struggling and not coping and dealing with mental health problems it's fucking horrible, and it's horrible for people around you, and it's not as easy as going, I'm not okay. Or this stuff that people...
The social media version of it. I'll just put that in a little window and go, guys, I was really struggling.
Yeah.
Well, here's a photo of me in tears. And you go, it's not that, is it?
Yeah, yeah.
It's like a huge black streak through your life that sucks everything in.
Yeah. And I don't know how helpful I mean, I'm sure it helps some people, but for me, it's also about how much you want to... You just don't want to just treat it glibly. The reality of it is just so different from that, and I don't know how much of a service is paid to it by treating it just as a slogan or as a, you know... So you don't want to seem like you're doing that as well, or jumping on some sort of bandwagon, which is I've never talked about it for that reason, but anyway, yeah.
Yeah. The end of Isaac Steele, which I found really moving, where he says to Timothy, there's something inside of me that I just can't reach. Mm. And I was proper like, oh, you prick, I wasn't expecting that, do you know what I mean? Like, it really, really got me. And I felt, did you, in the writing of it, was there, and I wish there was a better word for this, it's such a fucking stupid biblical word, but was there something whereby you felt a bit shriven for having kind of gone, oh, it's that. That's the thing.
Maybe. I mean, that expression, maybe. There's something in that relationship, and in Isaac is his struggle with love and connection, and that feels like something, you know, that's that quote that you just said, that's part of what he's saying is, I can't do this stuff. It sort of etch-a-sketches your mind, and I definitely can relate to that, the feeling out of reach, or feeling baffled by how you feel, or why you're behaving a certain way, or yeah.
What do you mean, etch-a-sketches your mind? Flesh that out for me, because I think that sounds good, but I don't quite know what you mean. Do you mean the shaky bit where you delete something?
You delete it, yeah. Where I think when I imagine Isaac as a character getting close to someone, and this it isn't true for me, I think. Maybe slightly, I don't know. But... it's like in that relationship, because also what I wanted in the story, because I feel like all good the comedies that I love, there's always love in there, there's always love somewhere, and that's why Isaac and Timothy's relationship becomes this sort of central thing, and a love affair, and that I imagined that in his mind that love, because I find love tricky, love's a tricky thing to learn. I feel like it's something that you have to get better at, like badminton or marksmanship. but love, getting close to it feels like getting close to like a fire, or that he's just got no, that it scrambles his mind. And Timothy's got all this love for him, and it just extra sketches his mind. He just doesn't know what to do with it, which is why he's so he lashes out, and why he drinks so much and drugs so much and all that stuff.
Having watched Flowers very recently, which is series two, the scene with Donald and Matilda in the car, where that's the very similar, there's a similar kind of tone to that, which is very, it's kind of, you embody it well in that performance, obviously that Will Sharpe's script, but you embody it well there, and you write it well in Isaac Steele, and you perform it well in that, you know, in the audiobook. Like, it doesn't exist as a book, does it?
No,
does it?
No.
Fuck it, is that annoying?
Well, we tried to get, it was such a bruising experience. I mean, total first world problem.
But, I can't get my audiobook in print.
My audiobook won't be a real book. but it's been rejected by like 12 publishers. 13, I think, actually. 13 publishers.
Even now the audiobook exists?
Even, and I think that was why it was so bruising, was because I dared to dream, because it had such a positive response. And there was such an overwhelmingly lovely response on Audible, and it's been reviewed so well by people who've listened to it, that I thought, oh, this will act as a bit of a proof of concept, so... And it is a book, it's just ready to go, it's just there. Please just... I mean, I could print it out, but I can't do as many as I'd like. And so, yeah, it just been absolutely told to fuck right off by everyone we approached. we're trying to, we're still working on it, but that all the major ones, all the ones that I thought, oh, this would be a good place for it because it does this, or a lot of them said, well, we do that, so we can't do this. So it was just like a really bruising.
Amazon, you like it? Audible's owned by Amazon.
Yeah.
Do Amazon want to make a series out of it? Have you considered that? Have you tried pitching it as a...
Not pitch that.
That's, you should pitch it. Why would you not pitch that? The budget's going to be big.
Yeah.
Or animated.
Yeah, it might work.
The budget could be big.
The budget would be big.
Yeah.
Oh, I'd love that. I mean, obviously, but that's just not, you know.
Have you got any plans for a sequel? And also, what elements of the experience would you want to repeat or not repeat?
I've started planning, and by started planning, what I mean is I've been playing a lot of Elden Ring. But there's a plan for a sequel. There's a plan for more stories in the universe, and I'd kind of sowed the seeds in the first one of a few kind of overhanging things that I want to sort of bring back. I wouldn't repeat the experience of not really writing a proper story in the first draft and then having to bin the whole thing. So
what would you do differently? Would you kind of do like a skeleton plot before you bother writing anything?
Yeah.
Bother's probably the wrong word in that context.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I think more planning. More planning definitely is good.
And knowing what you know now about what you accidentally wrote about yourself,
yeah,
what will that change about the writing of a sequel? Will you lean more into that and kind of dig more out of yourself?
Oh.
Or will your inclination be to go, whoo, I might have got a bit close to the source there?
I mean, I think the main aim with it was to write something diverting and really daft. And when the forefront of my mind whenever I'm writing is, what is daft? What is a funny thing to happen now? Wouldn't this be ridiculous? Those are always like the foremost questions. Because it essentially feels like an unserious exercise. And I don't necessarily want to deliberately go down any kind of contemplative navel gazing area with it.
Is there enough creativity or applause or laughs or anything like that? Is there enough of that in the world to, I don't know if I could ask this. I don't know if I'd ask this because I don't want to typify you as like, Daniel Rigby is a fucking basket case. You know what I mean? I don't think it comes across like this. And you've heard the show. You know how comics come across on this show a lot. But I suppose for the parts of you that aren't happy, for the parts of you that are depressed, for the parts of you that are kind of anywhere on that scale of kind of like a bit fucked off with everything and nihilistic to, shit, that's quite serious, you know, or anywhere on that spectrum. Can you fix those parts through your work temporarily or permanently? Or is it a case of like, there's therapy for getting fixed and there's work for doing work?
I think it should be, there's therapy for getting fixed and there's work for doing work. But as much as something feels not right about not doing it, I would like to, I think it will go some way to helping by doing it and making the effort to get laughs. But blimey, that's a hard question, yeah.
Are you happy?
Am I happy? I am at the moment, yeah. I am. I mean, I'm scared shitless. I'm anxious. Am I happy? I am happy at the moment. But there's always more happiness to be found.
So that was Daniel. What can I tell you to do? He doesn't, as far as I can tell, have a website, but you can follow him on Twitter at Daniel Rigby. And if he's going back into comedy in earnest, if he's going back into stand-up, he'll have a website before long. And it won't be on comedycv.co.uk, but perhaps he's still there. I don't know if you know about that site, comedycv.co.uk. When I started 15 years ago, you absolutely had to upload. It was like a kind of entry level, send a thing in, they put you on a website, suddenly you've got a biog page on a website. And I don't know what happened to it, but nothing has moved on it for many, many years. I hope whoever created it is still alive. There's a fun game. Go to comedy. Here's a game. Go to comedycv.co.uk and see what is the most famous person that you can see. Their very like the very first web page they ever had, and enjoy that. Send in your favourites to at ComComPod on Twitter. You can go as ever to comedianscomedian.com/insiders to sign up for only £2 a month to get hold of the extras from this episode, as well as the insider Q&As with Nish, with James Acaster. God, my God, I saw Nish Kumar's tour. I think it's nearly finished. It finishes in Basingstoke, and there's one or two other little weird bobbly places where Nish has, he's kind of doing ones that were sort of postponed or rescheduled because of the pandemic. So there are still a few chances in the UK to see his show, Your Power, Your Control. It is extraordinary. I love the man dearly, and I was jealous for a solid morning in that kind of tear up your notebook kind of, oh God, what's the point kind of a way, when you see someone truly brilliant, really inhabiting themselves and just with such an extraordinary volume of brilliant, brilliant jokes, as well as genuine meaning and passion and everything. Absolutely crazy about that show. So we will get him to return to the podcast before long, I promise. So all of that is on the Insiders thing. And I was talking about Daniel. Follow him on Twitter at Daniel Rigby. And please, 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 if you are remotely interested in sci-fi, and particularly the kind of Douglas Adams-y sort of sci-fi with brilliant ideas and silly world building and really coherent, inventive stuff, and very, very inflected with the kind of Britishness, which you may love no matter where you are from, if you're into that kind of thing, do yourself a favour. Sign up to the free trial on Audible and get hold of Isaac Steele and The Forever Man. Just give it the first half an hour. You'll be hooked, I promise. I love it to bits. This podcast is at ComComPod on Twitter and Instagram. And as I've said in the show notes, probably bloody TikTok as well by the time you read this. It is just spyware, isn't it? But you've got to be on the spyware these days. You can go to comedianscomedian.com, or you can find my stuff and sign up for the mailing list at stuartgoldsmith.com. I hope you can't hear a small banging clicking noise in the background, but you might hear that as I'm rocking back and forward on my new chair, which is called the Commodore. Not my name, the name given to it, given to this model by the wholesale chair people, Realm of Thrones. Yes! I bought the Commodore in grey. I recommend it. I like it. I because I'm sitting in the... This is post-amble stuff. Goodbye forever, and I'll speak to you in a minute. Bye! Got a corner desk, and I sort of sit in the sort of facing into the L shape, if you will. It's like an L shaped desk, but I hadn't realised that the old Commodore is the armrests bang against the sides of it, so I have to have the armrests too low, and that gets rid of at least most of the point of buying it. But there we are. It's got a sort of, I could have gone for the foam seat, but I didn't. I went for the mesh seat because it looked all futury, and I think the foam seat was probably more comfortable. But I've got a chair called the Commodore. I've made it. So what else can I tell you? What's been going on? Well, let's talk virality, if that's a word. I did a lovely time in Manchester and a clip from it went viral. Did I tell you about this last week? I may have done. Now it's on 4.4 million views. And the main thing I've learned is that it's made no difference whatsoever to my life. Very exciting to be in the position of going, oh, that's been like, I kind of saw the figures on it and kind of went, right, how can I replicate this? How can I turn this into a thing? Understandably. And only a week into the process did I stop and think, oh, that's interesting. 400,000 people, those the 10% of people or so that clicked like, 400,000 people liked that joke. And it was nice. And it's a good joke. It's the baby sign language bit from my Conan set. And it's very satisfying to think it's been seen by that many people. I think probably the whole Conan set on YouTube has only been seen by sort of less than 60,000, I think, which is nice. But who knows how real the, you know, who knows how many people watch it to the end or what have you. I just thought, oh, that's good. 400,000 people think that joke's as funny as I do. Oh, that's nice. And what that meant for me, as I said in my recent mail out, but here it is in person, is that I really felt like, oh my God, I have genuinely freed myself from desire. It was simply a very slight nice feeling and a sort of an excitement at thinking, oh, maybe I should get the bit between my teeth and do more of these sorts of things, upload more stuff. And I, like Grandfather Time, thinking perhaps there's something in this, uploading my stand-up clips to the internet. Well, maybe I'll give it a go. So it was very satisfying to see, satisfying to kind of finally be in the club of people who've had a thing go viral and can go, cool, interesting. And also satisfying to recognise that it's really not any more than that. But I think the key thing is that it's your conversion rate, right, people? It's your conversion rate. You've got to make sure that some of those, my conversion rate, the number of people that followed me as a result of it, must be something like 0.001. So you've got to work out how to upload the stuff and frame it such that people convert, by which I mean they start following you. Otherwise, it's just a load of randoms in America speculating that I absolutely have to be gay, and then people replying, no, he's British. So that's nice. And loads of other, yes, I've sort of stirred a bit of several hornet's nests to do with whether calling something baby sign language is cultural appropriation from people who use sign language. I have no position on that, but I'm open to being educated. And other things besides. When something's so successful, you sort of go, oh yeah, obviously someone in millions of people is going to be deeply offended by this. So it gave me a bit of a perspective on that as well. So that was fun. I'm going to keep this one brief solely because we have a play date and they will be marching into the house and stamping on the ceiling directly above my head moments from now. So I'll have a lovely play date, and I get the impression there it's a man called Alan who's come round to have a play date with me. I will go and muck in and do fun playing things with both myself and someone else's children. Ugh, weird. And you go off and do whatever you need to do. Next week, Bobby Mayer. And in the meantime, it's a cracking episode. And in the meantime, I'm going to get busy recording a whole load more of these. Speak to you soon.